National Edition. Coming up, Obama urges Russia to positively influence the situation in Ukraine. The importance of the Fatah and Hamas-Palestinian merger.
The vital sign in terms of the future of negotiations, the future of the Palestinian Authority.
One organizer of the Tiananmen Square demonstration speaks out. A call for Japan to take on a greater security role in the Asia-Pacific region. And a warning that football fans risk health and safety in Brazil. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. President Barack Obama is calling for Russia to help prevent the flow of weapons to separatists in eastern Ukraine and use its influence to get the militants there to support peace. Mr. Obama spoke today in Warsaw, Poland, his first stop on a three-nation visit to Europe that is expected to be dominated by the crisis in Ukraine.
We agree that further Russian provocation will be met with further costs for Russia, including, if necessary, additional sanctions. Russia has a responsibility to engage constructively with the Ukrainian government in Kiev to prevent the flow of militants and weapons into eastern Ukraine. Russia also needs to be using its influence with armed separatists to convince them to stop attacking Ukrainian security forces, leave buildings that they've seized, lay down their arms, and enter into the political process. Meanwhile, the United States and Poland will continue to support Ukrainians as they embark on political and economic reforms. We're prepared to help facilitate a dialogue between the Ukrainian government and representatives of separatist regions, and I look forward to discussing all this with President-elect Poroshenko tomorrow.
The president also proposed a $1 billion effort to boost military training and troop rotations in Europe, including more naval deployments in the Black and Baltic Seas. He said the initiative demonstrates America's unshakable commitment to its NATO allies. Russia has circulated its proposal for a UN Security Council resolution calling for humanitarian corridors and a ceasefire in southeastern Ukraine. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports that the draft text was met with skepticism from several council members.
Russia's UN envoy Vitaly Churkin told reporters the draft resolution demands the immediate cessation of hostilities, urges parties to commit to a sustainable ceasefire, and calls for the creation of humanitarian corridors to allow aid in and civilians safely out.
If this fighting continues, there is going to be even more hostility. There are going to be more casualties, more hostility. So by implication, it's going to make the political dialogue in Ukraine more difficult. I mean, we do have the political framework there, the Geneva Statement and the roadmap of the OSCE. But in order for that to work, violence needs to stop.
He said the resolution is intended to be non-politicized and purely humanitarian. Ukraine's envoy, Yuri Sergeyev, dismissed the Russian move.
The very fact that the resolution on Ukraine is tabled by Russian Federation is cynical and immoral. A country that has recently occupied and annexed a part of the territory of Ukraine, a country sponsoring terrorism and unrest in the eastern regions of Ukraine, now offers a settlement plan.
He said if Moscow wants to see an end to violence in southeastern Ukraine, it should stop sending fighters, weaponry, and money to pro-Russian factions there. After a hastily called referendum in March, watched over by Russian troops, the Crimean region of Ukraine voted to declare independence and was then annexed by Moscow. An insurgency erupted in parts of eastern and southern Ukraine shortly after, with many Western nations accusing Russia of financing and arming the rebels. Lithuanian Ambassador Raimonda Mermakate said it is ironic that after four vetoes on any action to stop the bloodshed and humanitarian catastrophe engulfing Syria for more than 3 years, Russia decided a humanitarian resolution is necessary for Ukraine.
We don't need a draft resolution. The only thing they can do is basically disown the rebels, stop supplies, stop financing, disassociate with them completely, and I think the issues will be settled within a very short period of time.
France's envoy said after reviewing the Russian text that it lacked important references, such as to the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine and the right of Ukraine to defend itself. He said several council members also said they would need a report from the United Nations Department of Humanitarian Affairs on the humanitarian situation in Ukraine. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
British veterans of the D-Day landings made a nostalgic return to the warship that played a pivotal role in the operation, HMS Belfast. On Monday, several dozen survivors attended a ceremony on board the ship, now a floating museum on the River Thames. 70 years ago, HMS Belfast was part of a huge armada, numbering thousands of vessels that crossed the sea from England to the Normandy coast. Edward Cordery, now 90 years old, spent 2 years on the Belfast as a torpedo operator, and on D-Day, he worked as a crane driver to bring on board the casualties from the beaches.
90% of them were past help. That's the sad thing of it, because the conditions of getting them to the ship weren't good from their survival point of view, you know. But he just did it in the hope that they would survive, but most of them came back on deck and were just by the side.
During the ceremony Monday, the veterans met with Prime Minister David Cameron.
70 years ago, you did your country proud, and your country will always, always be immensely proud of you. Thank you.
President Obama will speak Friday at Omaha Beach in Normandy in a ceremony marking the anniversary of D-Day. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has sworn in a new unity government between Fatah and Hamas, the two groups that have separately governed the West Bank and Gaza Strip for the past 7 years. We asked for reaction to the development from Michael Fishbach, a Mideast expert at Randolph-Macon College.
Well, I think there are several reactions that come to my mind. The first is that it is very important, and I think it symbolizes something very important among Palestinians, that the two main groups that represent the Palestinians are once again united, at least united in terms of how to govern the Palestinian Authority. There are obviously wider differences among them about how to proceed, whether to proceed in the peace process. So one of my reactions is that it marks, I think, a very important step in unifying the Palestinian ranks, which, whether one likes Hamas or not, or likes the unity government or not, is a vital sign in terms of the future of negotiations, the future of the Palestinian Authority. If the Palestinians themselves aren't united, they can't do anything. I think my second reaction is not one of surprise, but the idea that many people in the U.S. and Israel say that one must now boycott this government because of Hamas, I think is a bit overblown. First of all, as Hanan Ashrawi once said quite recently, a member of the PLO's executive council in Ramallah, that not all political parties in Israel and in the Israeli cabinet agree on how to proceed in the peace process, if to proceed in the peace process. There are vast differences among Israeli parties in the government about settlements. So the idea that all factions and all groups represented in the Palestinian government are somehow held to a standard that they all must agree on X, Y, and Z is a bit hypocritical. I think, secondly, it's important to realize that the new government, only four of the cabinet members were actually nominated by Hamas, and none of them are in Hamas. In fact, none of them are in Fatah either, except the president and the prime minister. So it is a caretaker government. And I think, therefore, some of the talk about, well, the Palestinians are turning their back on peace is a bit overblown.
Well, as you alluded to, the United States considers Hamas a terrorist organization. How is that going to fit in with the U.S. involvement in the peace process?
Well, I think the Obama administration is going to have to come up with a good answer publicly for why it was willing to deal very directly with the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan in securing the release of an American soldier who was held captive for 5 years, and at the same time say that it can't agree to talk to a group like Hamas. Or we can sidestep the whole question. The United States, I don't believe, has officially recognized the Taliban, but it has shown that when it is in the interest of the United States to do so, it's willing to talk to the Taliban. And I think all parties, certainly the United States, can do the same in terms of Hamas. Recognizing, agreeing with is one thing, but being willing to talk to is another. After all, peace is made among enemies, not among friends.
Michael Fishbach, author and Mideast expert at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. We hope to bring you more of his remarks Wednesday on International Edition. The United States says it intends for now to work with the new Palestinian unity government, including continued foreign assistance. But Washington says it will judge the government by its actions and calibrate its approach. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki spoke about the issue in a news briefing Monday.
Moving forward, we will be judging this government by its actions. Based on what we know now, we intend to work with this government, but we'll be watching closely to ensure that it upholds the principles that President Abbas reiterated today.
When you say based on what we know now, we intend to work with this government, does that mean that based on what you know now, you intend to continue dispersing U.S. foreign assistance to the Palestinian Authority and this government?
It does, but we will continue to evaluate the composition and policies of the new government and calibrate our approach accordingly.
Psaki says Mr. Abbas reaffirmed his support for the principles laid out by the Quartet on the Middle East, involving the United Nations, European Union, the United States, and Russia. Those principles include recognizing the State of Israel, renouncing violence, and abiding by previous agreements. U.S. President Barack Obama says a U.N. convention on the law of the sea would help ease tensions in the South China Sea if it is ratified by U.S. lawmakers. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns has the story.
China's facing a series of maritime disputes with its neighbors in the South China Sea. Speaking to Army cadets at West Point, President Obama says it's more difficult for the U.S. push for a resolution of rival claims because it exempts itself from rules that apply to everyone else.
We can't try to resolve problems in the South China Sea when we have refused to make sure that the Law of the Sea Convention is ratified by our United States Senate, despite the fact that our top military leaders say the treaty advances our national security. That's not leadership, that's retreat.
The UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS, establishes rules for commercial and military shipping, as well as the distribution of offshore oil and gas royalties. That's made it a target for the president's opponents, including former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
I do not believe the United States should endorse a treaty that makes it a legal obligation for productive countries to pay royalties to less productive countries based on rhetoric about common heritage of mankind.
While not ratified by the Senate, the United States does observe most of the structures of the Law of the Sea Treaty. American Enterprise Institute analyst Michael Oslin.
I think the president was making a false choice. He was saying if we don't ratify UNCLOS, we can't call China to account for any of its provocative, coercive, and aggressive behavior. That's completely false. Of course we can.
The latest flare-up in the South China Sea concerns a Chinese oil rig in disputed waters off Vietnam, a standoff that Chinese Deputy Army Chief Wang Guangzong says is being forced on Beijing.
China, in its issues concerning territorial sovereignty and maritime rights, has never taken the first step to provoke trouble. It has always been that China has been forced to respond.
Vietnamese protesters say Beijing's trying to provoke wider confrontation over disputed islands. American University professor Hilary Mann Leverett says Beijing's trying to undermine U.S. alliances in Asia.
The way China has done that is to push these allies over issues that the United States doesn't really care about. Craggy Island here, Craggy Island there. Why should the United States really send the 7th Fleet out to fight China over these various islands?
U.S. reluctance to confront China has nothing to do with the Law of the Sea, says Oslin.
I think it shows a very disturbing trend line in the Obama administration of trying to find excuses for not getting more involved in the maritime and naval disputes that are roiling Asia.
The Philippines is using Law of the Sea mechanisms to challenge China's territorial claims, but China's refusing to join that non-binding tribunal. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Asia analyst Clyde Prestowitz says it's time for Japan to take on a greater security role in the Asia-Pacific region, even if it requires amending its pacifist post-war constitution. Prestowitz, a former trade negotiator and now president of the Washington-based Economic Strategy Institute, says Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's pronouncement at a security summit in Singapore that Tokyo intends to play an even greater and more proactive role in making peace more certain should receive U.S. support. Prestowitz, writing a column for the Reuters news agency, told VOA's Victor Beatty, Japan's leadership appears to have come to the conclusion that it can no longer rely on the American security guarantee.
So Abe is planning and acting to strengthen Japan's ability to defend itself and to to develop a network of allies and security agreements with other countries in the region independent of the U.S. So I actually thought it was a very positive statement from Abe.
Well, China didn't.
No, they didn't. I'm not surprised. But, of course, one reason Abe is doing this is because he shares with some of the ASEAN countries problem of disputes over disputed territories in the Western Pacific and the South China Sea. He shares that problem along with Vietnam, the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, and so forth.
Are China and Japan on a collision course?
I don't like to say collision course, but they are kind of playing bumper cars here. The Japanese claim that there is no dispute, that they absolutely have sovereignty over the Senkaku Islands. The Chinese argue that there is a dispute, but they also have a claim to the islands, and they argue that their claim is better than Japan's. And they're trying to get the Japanese to admit that there's a dispute. And so it's kind of an undeclared dispute, I guess, but it's getting rough.
Your article would suggest that the Obama administration's pivot or rebalance toward Asia-Pacific may not be all that is cracked up to be, that perhaps the United States cannot do what it used to do in Asia-Pacific region.
The U.S. remains the strongest power in the region, but I think that the U.S. established these structures and relationships in the Cold War, and the Cold War is over. The issue between China and Japan, let's say, over the Senkaku Islands, is important to Japan. It's not really important to the United States. The U.S. has no stake in the Senkaku Islands directly. It does through Japan, but not directly. My view is that the allies of the U.S., Korea, Japan, Philippines, we call them allies, but they're really not allies. They have no, under the agreements, they have no obligation to defend the United States. In fact, at the moment, as the Japanese Constitution stands, Japan is not even able to support U.S. military efforts that are aimed at defending Japan. You know, what I'm arguing is that this whole structure needs to be rearranged and that the countries themselves need to do more in terms of their own defense and not draw the United States into conflicts with China in which U.S. interests are really not at stake.
Currently, Article 9 of Japan's post-war constitution states the Japanese people forever renounce war as the sovereign right of the nation. Revising that would take a two-thirds vote of both houses of parliament. Prestowitz says while Japan's leadership is prepared to amend the constitution, the Japanese people may not. He says it remains a source of hot debate in the country. However, over time, Prestowitz foresees a time when Asian nations increasingly take on a more active role in defending their own national security interests and rely on the United States as, in his words, the call of last resort rather than the call of first resort. The brutal killing of a woman inside a McDonald's restaurant in eastern China is highlighting the sometimes violent tactics of a banned religious cult. Rebecca Valley has more from Hong Kong on the Eastern Lighting Church.
Footage of last week's deadly attack was captured on a mobile phone and has since been covered extensively in China's state-backed media and social media. The altercation began after the victim, a 35-year-old woman who was also dining at the McDonald's, refused to give her phone number to one of the suspects. One video shows the group ganging up against the victim. A woman's voice is heard telling onlookers not to get involved or they would be killed as well. Police apprehended the suspects who say they are members of a religious cult, Quan Neng Sheng, or Almighty God. In an interview given to state media after he was arrested, one of the suspects admitted to participating in the killing and said the victim was an evil spirit. He says he beat her because she was a monster, an evil spirit. The goal was to beat her to death, he says. After searching the suspects' homes, investigators found illegal religious material. A local law enforcement official told China's state TV broadcaster the suspects will be charged with using a cult to sabotage law enforcement. The Church of Almighty God, also known as Eastern Lightning Church, has been active in China since the early 1990s. Its main teachings include the belief that God has been reincarnated as a woman in rural China. The church has repeatedly come to the attention of Chinese authorities for its violent practices. In 2012, police arrested hundreds of followers after they'd spread rumors about doomsday, the end of the world. The same year, a man whom authorities say was under the influence of the cult stabbed 23 children in a primary school in Henan province. Hong Kong-based American pastor Dennis Balcombe says he was attacked by cult members after they tried to persuade him to join their church.
They're very wicked people. It's not just like a religious group, you know. They will kidnap you. They will use extortion. They'll try to use sex, you know, to get you in a compromising position, to try to get you to either give money or join them.
The church has an estimated following of about 3 million people, which Balcombe says is an impressive number, considering the pressure they are under.
Where there's more prosperity, where the educational level is higher, they don't seem to be as strong. Yet they do go everywhere. They will try to contact people. But in some of these more rundown areas, the rural areas, they seem to be making a lot of progress.
An underage boy also took part in the attack at the McDonald's. According to Chinese media, he was the son and brother of three of the suspects arrested. Rebecca Valli reporting from Hong Kong for VOA.
A quarter of a century after the deadly crackdown on demonstrators gathered in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, one of the student organizers of those demonstrations, Chai Ling, talks about what happened then in the context of today.
We also hope this year, 25th anniversary, will be the time that the new leadership of China will have the courage to face what happened in 1989 and the brutal massacre, to be able to owning up both the mistake of making those decisions and also the enormous pain and consequences it caused the victims' families. We pray to hope the leader of China today will compensate those victims' families, give them the right to mourn openly, publicly, so they can heal, and also to hold accountable for those who have ordered and executed the massacre. But we do pray for this process would take place in a spirit of both in truth and also in forgiveness, and lead to ultimate reconciliation and freedom in China.
Speaking with Reuters TV, Chai Ling, who now lives in the U.S. city of Boston, Massachusetts, credits God with her ability to forgive those who ordered the Tiananmen massacre. Chai's forgiveness has not set well with some others. The group Tiananmen Mothers responded harshly, expressing disappointment with Chai and underscoring their call for truth, compensation, and accountability. Tiananmen Mothers is a group made up of family members of those killed during the Tiananmen Square protest in 1989. Some young people in China today feel the events of June 4, 1989 have been wiped out of Chinese history. It is absent from textbooks and classrooms. It is scrubbed off China's internet and is missing from its own version of Wikipedia. But Lu Shuxuan, a student in Beijing, told Associated Press, even with efforts to erase the events of Tiananmen, somehow the story has survived. This month, fans from around the world will be heading to Brazil for football's FIFA World Cup. But reporter Art Chimes tells us public health experts advise there could be more at risk than a disappointing result on the field.
Experts at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say travelers visiting Brazil may be exposed to a variety of health and safety risks. Dr. Joanna Gaines in the CDC's Geographic Medicine branch says there always are risks to health and safety while traveling, but she cautions that for those going to Brazil for the World Cup or the 2016 Olympics,
travelers who are attending special events like these may be at an increased risk.
In an online article published in the medical journal JAMA Internal Medicine, Gaines and her colleagues recommended vaccinations or preventive medicine for infectious diseases, including yellow fever and malaria. In other cases, travelers should be aware of steps they can take to avoid getting infected, for example, with dengue fever.
There's no medication or a vaccine to prevent it, So we really recommend that travelers are regularly using insect repellents, wearing long-sleeve clothing, wearing clothing that's been treated with insect repellent, and doing those types of active things that they can do to protect their health.
Travelers are urged to check with their doctor before going, says the article, and doctors should alert their patients to hazards ranging from bed bugs and sexually transmitted diseases to crime and traffic accidents.
Most of the roads in Brazil are actually not paved, and we do recommend that travelers be particularly vigilant. So really being careful when they are driving, making sure that you're trying to find a vehicle that does have the safety features that you want. So, I mean, at a minimum, seatbelts for sure.
In their article, Dr. Gaines and her colleagues say travelers should see their healthcare practitioner at least a month before leaving and seek immediate attention if they develop a fever during or after their trip to Brazil. This is Art Chimes reporting.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On June 3, 1726, Scottish scientist James Hutton, widely considered the father of modern geology, was born. Hutton expanded on the study of minerals and rocks in his publication, Theory of the Earth, in which he proposed that the Earth had developed over a long period of time rather than being created all at once. On this day in 1808, Jefferson Davis, the only president of the secessionist Confederate States of America, was born. Davis, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, was elected to Congress and appointed Secretary of War. A strong supporter of states' rights and slavery, Davis returned to his native Mississippi when it withdrew from the Union. In 1899, Austrian composer Johann Strauss II died. Strauss is best known for his waltzes, including the Blue Danube. The composer was widely acclaimed as the king of the waltz in Europe and the United States. In 1962, a chartered Air France Boeing 707 jetliner en route from Paris to Atlanta, Georgia, crashed during takeoff, killing 130 people on board. On this day in 1989, Chinese army troops headed to Beijing to put down a huge student-led pro-democracy demonstration. Also in 1989, Iran's Grand Ayatollah Khomeini died. The Ayatollah, an Iranian Shiite leader, returned from exile in France to lead the Iranian Islamic Revolution. And on June 3, 1999, Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic agreed to end the conflict against Kosovo. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In light of Madagascar's successful 2013 elections and installation of a new government, the United States has lifted restrictions on provision of foreign assistance to the Indian Ocean island nation. The restrictions had been put in place following a coup d'etat in 2009. President Ari Rajaonarimampiam's taking office and naming a new cabinet ends a political crisis that damaged the nation's economy and cost it much support in the international community. Although the United States joined other nations in cutting off direct aid to Madagascar's government, our country remained the nation's largest partner, providing more than $61 million in food security, health, and disaster assistance in 2013 alone. Approximately 150 Peace Corps volunteers served there as well. As the African Union now has lifted its suspension of Madagascar's membership, and the United States is removing all remaining coup-related aid restrictions, President Rajaonarimampiam has been invited to attend the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit to be held in Washington this summer. Madagascar's return to democratically elected government represents an opportunity for it to make progress on strengthening democratic rights, combating corruption, and rebuilding its economy. We look forward to working productively with the nation's new leaders as they work to secure a democratic and prosperous future for the Malagasy people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.